This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, Vice President of Security Technology at Synopsys and author of Software Security. This podcast is co-sponsored by Synopsys and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 135th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have today with me Ksenia Dmitrieva Peguero, which is impossible to pronounce. So tell me how to say that right, Ksenia.
Dmitrieva Peguero.
Dmitrieva Peguero. That sounds better when you say it. So Ksenia is a principal consultant at Synopsys in the Software Integrity Group. Ksenia has many years of hands-on experience in software security and system security. She's an expert in many software security practices, including penetration testing, static analysis tool, design, execution, customization and deployment, and threat modeling. Throughout her career as a consultant, Ksenia has established and evolved secure coding guidance and best practices for many different firms, and has delivered numerous software security training sessions. She's passionate about cutting-edge web technologies and probing system security. Ms. Dmitrieva speaks regularly around the world on topics such as HTML5, CSP, and JavaScript. Ksenia has degrees in education and computer science from Clemson and an MS in computer science from George Washington University. She lives in Virginia with her husband and a brand new baby girl. So thanks for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Congrats on the birth of Sophia Tamara 12 days ago. Holy cow.
Yep.
Yeah, what's it like to be a brand new mom?
It's much harder than being a security consultant, I tell you that.
It's sort of a never-ending rhythm at this point, from what I recall.
Yes, there is no deadline on Friday, and then you can go for, you know, have a weekend. It's never-ending deadline.
So you've been doing hands-on software security in the real world for many years. How's the field evolved since you started doing consulting about 7 years ago?
I think 7 years ago, a lot of people didn't even know what I was talking about, you know, what we as a company were talking about. One example I remember for hiring people at Sigital, including myself, we would look for people with just programming experience, and we didn't care about security experience, and you would kind of learn everything on the job. And these days, there are degrees in the universities in, you know, security, and we expect the students to know what security is and have some experience. And then when you talk to the clients, they also know what software security is. They definitely heard of penetration testing and static analysis. So the awareness is definitely much higher.
I guess that makes it easier to get straight to working, maybe. Do you think we've made progress as a field in those 7 years, beyond just awareness?
Yeah, beyond awareness. I mean, there are still bugs, there are still problems. But I think we are making progress. The field has definitely grown. There is more demand. So there is more understanding of what kind of problems we are trying to solve, right? Mm-hmm. What is the difference between security software versus all the other things that have to do with IT and security in the company?
Right.
In terms of quality, that I don't know.
Maybe more awareness and more people wanting it, but the quality remained constant?
Well, as you say, there is more software, there is more bugs, and because there are more things to be attacked now, we have Internet of Things, and there's, you know, software and mobile devices and software everywhere in cars and everywhere else. So it may look like there are more security issues, but it's probably also just, you know, us being more aware, us as a society being more aware of that, and that getting more publicity on the news, that it may look more scary than 7 years ago. So it's hard to say if we made any qualitative progress in that.
Okay, well, let's go after it a different way. So if you were able to fix any practice area in software security, which one do you think requires the most attention these days? Like, what's the farthest behind, or we have the most work to do?
Probably threat modeling, I would say, and architecture reviews. Is that farthest behind because that's the more complicated one, and people have very different descriptions of what it is and very different understanding of what it is. Everybody has their own version of, you know, threat modeling and risk analysis. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that's the one lagging behind.
Okay. And it may be partly because it's harder to automate, because, you know, we can build a computer program to go through our code and look for bugs, but you can't really build a similar system to go through a design and look for flaws.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely less tooling. And the reason why there is less tooling, because it's much more involved. So, you know, maybe with the development of artificial intelligence, we'll be better in developing some sort of automation in understanding the design and understanding the problems of design.
Yeah, I'm not holding my breath for that one. Having worked on AI 25 years ago, I think we're just barely making progress in that field too. But who knows? I think you're right. I agree with you about the architecture, you know, being behind, figuring out how to do analysis that way. Let's talk about frameworks a little bit, because I know you've been working in web-based systems for a while. So these frameworks like JavaScript, you know, have been popping up all over the place. I'm thinking about Angular and Node and Express and things like that. So in your view, with all those things, do all frameworks have the same security posture?
Definitely not. So all frameworks have the problem or the issue of building security into the framework and how much each, you know, framework, developer, framework maintainer wants to make security part of the framework. Unfortunately, these days, that's not the highest priority for a framework. We're still going for more features. For speed, performance is definitely there.
Right.
But security, only very, very few frameworks think about security, like Angular and Spring, you know, Java framework. But most of them don't bother about it. And then what happens is developers are left to solve all the security problems themselves, even when they're using the framework. And every developer is solving the same problem. You know, everybody needs authentication. Everybody needs some sort of validation. And
right.
Instead of having these features built on the framework, they have to reinvent the wheel every single time.
And they do the wrong thing when they roll their own. So you think that the developers of the frameworks have more responsibility to do some stuff that the developers using the frameworks can use?
I think so. That would be the perfect way to fix more issues in the code. And it's on one hand, should be the responsibility of the framework maintainers and developers. On the other hand, it should be the demand from the developers that when they choose the framework, they should look into, oh, you know, what's the security posture of this framework? I don't see any questions on forums, you know, Stack Overflow saying, hey, which framework is more secure, right? Usually you see the question, hey, which framework has more of this visual components or is faster or, you know,
right,
has better
right.
connection with the database.
Right. So still, it's a property of a system that's just not that high on the priority list. So the developers building the frameworks don't really get to it. And then the developers who are using the frameworks can screw everything up from a security perspective. So do they? Do they?
they do.
What do they do? Like,
so, you know, if we take validation, some sort of validation, right? There are different things they can do. They can either write their own routine to validate, you know, address, email address, etc. And that will most likely be some code copied from, you know, Stack Overflow or some other GitHub repository that, you know, we don't know how good the quality is.
Right.
Sometimes there are third-party libraries that they can use. And, you know, depending on developer, depending on the framework, depending on how well the library is integrated with the framework, they may be using that third-party library, which oftentimes is a better solution, you know, a little bit more validated, updated, and more secure. But yeah, in both cases, they have opportunities to screw things up, because even if you use a third-party library or a plugin, it usually requires some configuration. Like we've seen these examples in Angular, where a plugin comes with pretty good default security settings.
Uh-huh.
But they don't satisfy some features that developers need, so they turn off security settings, they change them, and basically the plugin doesn't do the job that it's supposed to do.
Right, right. So you spent a bunch of time digging into Angular and thinking about how to automate aspects of security analysis. So what have you learned about Angular, and what have you done to get that into automation?
Angular is interesting. On one hand, it's client-side code, right? And as we know, we don't trust anything that runs on the client. A lot of things can be bypassed. But then on the other hand, the way that templating is done in Angular actually provides a pretty good protection, for example, from cross-site scripting. Mm-hmm. And in terms of automatically finding the problems, that is still a big question. Like, there is still not really a good tool that can do that. It's possible to find some data flow and cross-site scripting issues. Mm-hmm. But with the issues that have to do with the configuration of the framework or plugins, the problem is that they get updated so often, right?
I see. So it's sort of it's a moving target.
Yeah, we're always chasing that, and there are updates every couple of months, and you know, new version of Angular is coming out, and not everything changes, but still, there may be enough changes that our automated tools don't find things anymore.
So have you guys, building those automated tools, talked to the developers that are building Angular about this problem?
No, we have not communicated directly to them.
But are they aware of what you're doing? I mean, I'm trying to figure out what framework developers think about beyond security features and input monitoring. Like, there have to be, and you said that's even hard to keep up with, so I'm trying to figure out how that all washes out.
Well, from the Angular developer standpoint, they are, from my understanding, you know, as I said, we haven't communicated directly to them, but yeah. When they introduce new features, they oftentimes say, hey, this is a breaking build, and we kind of don't care about the older versions. We don't have the requirements or the desire to support whatever was built before, so mm-hmm. We're just going to go ahead and start a new version.
So you have to figure out what they did and then figure out how to adjust whatever you built to work again.
Yeah,
every time.
Yeah, on one hand, yes. But then on the other hand, the developers who started using, say, you know, Angular 1.6, and now Angular 2 is out, and now Angular 3 is coming out as well, developer would just stick with the version because if they want to use the new version of Angular 2, for example, they have to rewrite their whole application. And not every company will do that. So on one hand, if developers are still using the older 1.6 version, then the tools that we built for 1.6 will still work. But they won't work for a new application.
Right, right. God, this is just too complicated. So what, you know, what are the biggest open problems? You think that version controlling and kind of keeping everything somewhat similar in terms of its security posture is the biggest open problem?
I think one of the problems is, yes, keeping up to date, basically, to all the versions and to all the new features and plugins. That's one issue. And then the second problem is keeping up to date to different frameworks because, you know, it's last year Angular was number one, was so popular. I think it's probably fading out these days and React is stepping in. And, you know, now we need to build all these automation tools for React. And then 6 months later, it's going to be something else.
Right. So there's kind of a fashion or a style with these frameworks, like which one you choose. It's like what kind of clothes you wear.
We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, make sure to check out my other projects on GaryMcGraw.com. There you can find writings, videos, and even original music.
Here's a trick question. Are you ready for a trick question? What's more important, code review or architectural risk analysis?
I would say it depends on the application. Uh-huh. If the application is your standard, web app that has a database, a backend, and a frontend, then you may not gain as much in doing architecture risk analysis, and you may just start with a code review and get kind of more bang for the buck.
Yeah, that makes sense because the pattern is so normal, or you've seen it so many times, people have mostly got that straight.
Yeah, it's a known pattern. It's known architecture. But if it's something unusual, right? If it's some software in the car or some very complicated thing, then yes, definitely we should start with the architecture risk analysis.
Okay, so how do you think that code review and ARA are related to each other?
Well, you would start, so for example, if you're reviewing a complex system, right, you will start with an ARA, and then that will help you identify what are the potential issues. And then to find if these potential issues actually exist in the system, you would do a code review, right?
Okay.
So you would look at something and say, hey, you know, this system is talking to this third-party backend that it has its own protocol. So how about we review the code of this third-party backend and this protocol and how the communication happens? And that's, you know, in doing code review on that, we may find some issues.
So I'm thinking of how to tie in this framework stuff and code review and ARA all together, and wondering whether if you made certain changes to the design of a framework, you could maybe eradicate entire classes of bugs all at once because you made a design change, made it impossible for developers who use the frameworks to do certain things because of a design decision. You think that's a possibility?
Probably, especially if the framework covers big security controls such as authentication and authorization, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If authorization, for example, has been built into the framework, then all you need to do, and you know that the way developers are, you know, writing code, they are following the framework standards, the framework requirements, then to review the authorization, you may just need to check a couple configuration files. And you don't need to do a whole code review trying to understand, you know, what are the roles and what are the permissions and how this is all interrelated.
I was thinking about, too, like something, you know, cross-site scripting, for example, you know, requires a certain base design in order to be a problematic bug in some sense. And you could maybe get rid of that by changing the design, making it so that developers can't do the calls the way they kind of want to. Makes it a little bit harder for them to get their work done, but it also makes it impossible to do cross-site scripting. I don't know. It's just an idea.
Yeah, that's definitely possible. Angular is a great example of that, right? So Angular has the built-in output encoding for any data that reaches a template. And so the change in the framework that they did is the separation of the template and mm-hmm. then the data that comes from the server. And so whatever comes from the server and becomes part of the template gets automatically encoded using their strict contextual encoding. And then, so the only way for a developer to actually have a cross-site scripting or have an unencoded data that's coming from the server in the page is to intentionally say, hey, I trust this code, and basically turn off your encoding
right.
and, you know, send it the way it is. So yeah. then to find this issue, it's very easy. You just search for a couple of function calls that say, hey, trust this HTML, and kind of you're done.
Right. So that's a way that, you know, making a change, an architectural change to the framework can help get code review to be easier. So maybe we are making progress.
Well, yeah, code review is encoding and, you know, coding and having fewer issues. Yeah, I was actually just recently looking at three groups of applications. You know, one's built with the template engine EGS, also JavaScript template engine, one built with Jade or Pug template engine, and one group of applications built with Angular, and they're all open source applications on GitHub.
Yeah.
And the number of cross-site scripting, the real cross-site scripting issues that are not false positive in the Angular applications are much, much lower. They're like 7% of the apps were vulnerable compared to 30-40% of the apps for EGS and Jade.
Yes, that's really interesting. So maybe we can make progress.
We're sure I can.
All right, so you've experienced and lived in different cultures all over the world. And I'm wondering, do diverse cultures, sociological cultures, approach computer security differently? Or is it the same? Or is it so new? I'm trying to... Is there an angle there?
I don't know. I haven't thought about it, and I cannot come up with a good example. I don't think there is any difference between culture and computer security, at least in the societies and the countries that I've lived in and worked. So, I'm from Russia originally. I worked in Europe. I worked in the U.S. At least in these countries, I didn't see any differences in how people understand or relate to computer security. Maybe in other cultures it's different.
Well, I mean, there's certainly different aspects of those cultures not related to computer security, but I just wondered if it leaked into that at all. Maybe it's because computer security is so relatively new that, you know, everybody's grappling with it the same way.
Yeah, maybe it's because it's relatively new, and maybe it's because it's so technical. I think, it, you know, if you look at some other industries or some other, like, areas of knowledge, like education or psychology or maybe medicine, there may be cultural differences. Mm-hmm. But if you look at technical stuff, you know, math and computers, I think it's pretty straightforward in any culture.
Fair enough, because math is math. Yep.
Yep.
So you give a lot of talks all over the place, and I'm interested to know what your favorite conference to attend is, or maybe to give a talk in.
Oh, that's a tough one. I think one of my favorites was so far has been AppSec in Europe. AppSec okay. EU was really, really great. And maybe that's because there's a couple of reasons. There was great concentration of web technology experts. So that's just my, you know, play field and play area where all the experts are, and I just enjoy communicating with them and interacting with them and listening to all these amazingly smart people. But also in Europe, I think people are very relaxed and very friendly and less commercialized than in the U.S.
Yeah, so it's a little bit more, I don't know, like a club or something?
It's more like a club. It's more like exchange of ideas and not exchange of business cards and promotional materials.
Right. That's a good answer. Another question. So as a hardcore technologist and a woman, what is your view of sexism in the field? Do you think it's harder to gain respect as a technologist if you're a woman?
Yes. Unfortunately, it's there. It is harder to gain respect, for sure. And I think it's harder to gain respect on a medium level. So I think when you are at a higher level, you know, like, for example, if you are speaking at a big conference, of course, there are right now requirements by, you know, from the society that, oh, we should be equally represented. And so some conferences maybe even favor more women and select talks, you know, of women versus men. So it's kind of a reverse sexism. But right. At the medium level, working with the clients and establishing your position and trust with the client as a woman may be harder, definitely.
Yeah, no, that makes
I've experienced that.
You have to sort of prove yourself a little bit more somehow.
Yes.
Does that definitely. Seem right? Yeah.
And I've been in situations where I would be working with a male colleague, you know, both of us and the client, and the client would just interact more with my male colleague and not me.
Even though you probably knew more than the other guy.
Sometimes, yes.
Oh, come on, always.
Yep.
All right, last question and a total flyer. So one of the coolest things you do is competitive ballroom dancing, and boy, are you guys fun to watch when you do that. So when did you start dancing, and did you ever think about going pro?
Oh, when did I start dancing? That was a long time ago. Oh, let's see, 2007. Gosh, 10 years ago. 10
Holy
years
cow.
Ago, yes.
Wow.
Going pro, no, I've never thought about that because, I started in Russia, and then most of the people in Russia start ballroom dancing when they're 6, 7 years old.
Okay.
No, I started much. I was not 6 years old when I started. So for me, it was all. And what I was doing in Russia is called hobby class. So
right. It's
only if you are starting after college, that's only treated as a hobby. Like there is
no way
you can become.
You can't go pro. Well, you might be able to if you just made your life only about that.
Yeah, in the U.S. you can, and yes, you have to just make your life out of it. But yeah, for me, it's just a hobby, which still. I spend a lot of time on that and, you know, get a lot of pleasure out of it, but it's a hobby.
Oh, that's cool. Well, it's fun to watch. Hopefully we'll figure out a link so we can put on the podcast so people can see you doing it.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we can do that.
Thanks for your time today. It's been really interesting.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Synopsys and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Cert Security. The January-February issue of IEEE S&P Magazine includes our interview with Marie Moe, a Norwegian researcher who hacks her own pacemaker, so check that out. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.